Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Joshua chapter 2. Our context is this. In Joshua chapter 1, God has commissioned Joshua, telling him to be very strong and courageous. In fact, the people of Israel told Joshua to be strong and courageous. God told Joshua to be strong and courageous. Moses told Joshua to be strong and courageous. So that was sort of the theme of the last chapter. And now we start in verse 1 of chapter 2. This is the story of Rahab and the two Jewish spies. So we start with verse 1. Then Joshua the son of Nun sent two men as spies secretly from Shittim, saying, "Go view the land, especially Jericho." So they went and came into the house of a harlot whose name was Rahab and lodged there. Now Rahab lived there in Jericho. Joshua the son of Nun was at Shittim. Shittim is a place. Shittim means acacia wood. It was some kind of plain or valley there in the plains of Moab near Mount Pisgah, Mount Moab, where Moses had died. Joshua sent two men as spies. Now, when did he send them? Then KJ margin has he had sent, and that's probably the correct reading because, as Adam Clark says, it's very likely the spies had been sent out soon after the death of Moses, and they had spent 3 days dealing with Rahab and came back, and then Joshua told the Israelites to get ready in 3 days. At any rate, the spies had to be come back. They could not have been sent any later than the day that Moses told the Israelites to get ready in 3 days, because otherwise the Israelites couldn't have left in 3 days because the spies wouldn't have been back in time. We see in Joshua 1:10-11 where Joshua had told the people that Joshua commanded the officers of the people, "Go through the camp and tell the people, get provisions ready for yourselves, for within 3 days you will be crossing the Jordan to go in and take possession of the land the Lord your God is giving you to inherit." So even though this verse 1 sounds like then Joshua the son of Nun sent two men, even though it sounds like it happened after chapter 1 where Moses told the people to get ready in 3 days, they got ready in 3 days, getting ready to go, and then Joshua sent, I don't think so. I think that rather the spies had already been sent, they came back, and then Joshua told the people to get ready. Now, why were the two spies sent across the Jordan, west of the Jordan, to find out what the situation was like in Jericho? Now, here's some options, three options. They're not mutually exclusive. The first is from John Gill. They were not sent to spy the land, as the spies in the time of Moses, to see what sort of land it was and what sort of people dwelt in it, but to reconnoiter it, to know where it was best to lead the people at first and encamp, and particularly to observe the passes and avenues leading to Jericho, the first city in it nearest to them of importance. Well, that makes sense. It's just a military operation. Option number 2, Gill says the purpose of the spies was, quote, to, quote, pick out the thoughts of the inhabitants of the land, what apprehensions they had of the people of Israel, whether disheartened and dispirited at their near approach, and what were their intentions, resolutions, and preparations to act against them offensively or defensively. Again, to determine the psychology of the enemy, that's a military operation. So to learn the geography, learn the psychology that they were facing. Third option, they sent spies to make sure Jericho could be taken. It was absolutely necessary to have possession of Jericho. It was sort of the gateway to the land of Canaan. They had to have it. If they bypassed Jericho, went further into the land and conquered, the Israelites could not survive an enemy in their rear. Jericho would be in their rear. They'd just come after them. So they had to have Jericho. Now, the spies were sent out secretly. Secretly from whom? From the Canaanites? Well, the problem with that's sort of redundant. Of course, spies operate secretly, so why would Moses write here, or excuse me, not Moses, why would the author of Joshua say they were sent out secretly? Well, my answer to that is maybe the text is just redundant. So what? There's a lot of times people write things redundantly in a text, and maybe Joshua just says he sent them out secretly so that the Canaanites couldn't find out what they were doing. However, it could be that Joshua sent the spies out secretly to keep them secret from the Israelites, to keep the Israelites from thinking Joshua was afraid of the Canaanites, which would, of course, discourage the Israelites. Or maybe it was just a matter of security. If all the Israelites knew that the spies were leaving, the word could get out and could leak to the Canaanites. So I think that what is meant here is that the spies were sent out secretly so that none of the other Israelites would know, so that the operation could remain a secret. So the spies went and they came into the house of a harlot whose name was Rahab. Now there's an interesting controversy here about whether Rahab was a whore or was she not a whore. Well, the first question we have before we get into that is, if this was the house of a harlot, why would spies first go to a whorehouse? That seems sort of a bad choice of places to go if you're going to be a spy. Were they going for sex? No, obviously not. But they might be going for lodging and food. Now, maybe it was a whorehouse, and maybe they knew it was a whorehouse, but there's nowhere else to get lodging and food. So they went to the whorehouse, not for the women, but for food and shelter. Or they could have gone to what was a public inn, and they found out later it was a whorehouse once they got there. It was common in the ancient world for public inns to be run by prostitutes. So let's just say the spies knew it was a whorehouse, but in defense of their morals, they had to have food and lodging. Now, another option is it wasn't a whorehouse at all. Now, Adam Clark is bound and determined to preserve Rachel's reputation, and he says that she was just a hostess of an inn. Here's what Clark says. I am fully satisfied that the term zona in the text, which we translate harlot, should be rendered tavern or innkeeper or hostess. In another place, Clark says this, quote, is it therefore likely that persons who could not escape apprehension and death without the miraculous interference of God should, in despite of that law, which at this time must have been so well known unto them, go into a place where they might expect not the blessing but the curse of God? Is it not therefore more likely that they went rather to an inn or lodge than to a brothel? But what completes, in my judgment, the evidence on this point is that this very Rahab, whom we call a harlot, was actually married to Salmon, a Jewish prince. See Matthew 1:5. He's in the genealogy there, genealogy of Jesus. And is it probable that a prince of Judah would have taken to wife such a person as our text represents Rahab to be? Well, I don't know why Adam Clark is so bound and determined to say Rahab wasn't a harlot. She could have been a reformed harlot when she married Salmon. I mean, that happens. Let's read another quote from Clark. As our blessed Lord came through the line of this woman, it cannot be a matter of little consequence to know what moral character she sustained. As an innkeeper, she might be respectable, if not honorable. As a public prostitute, she could be neither, and it is not very likely that the providence of God would have suffered a person of such a notoriously bad character to enter into the sacred line of his genealogy. Now, that's interesting because so many people have preached the sermon. See there, it doesn't matter what your birth is. It's election, not your works. Rahab obviously was not a good worker. She didn't do good work. She was a prostitute, but God chose her anyway. So Adam Clark just ruined a good sermon by saying that Rahab's not a prostitute. Clark goes on to say, it is true that the cases of Tamar and Bathsheba might be thought sufficient to destroy this argument. No, because Tamar and Bathsheba are in those genealogies, and they were. Tamar was a prostitute in one case when she seduced, which pretended to be a prostitute and got Judah, her father-in-law, to have sex with her. And Bathsheba, we know the story, she was seduced by David, so she wasn't really a prostitute, but their morals were not so good, but they were in the genealogies. But Clark goes on to say, whoever considers these two cases maturely will see that they differ totally from that of Rahab, if we allow the word harlot to be legitimate. Well, I guess I'm not mature then, because I don't see the cases that much different from Rahab. It's the same thing. People of a sexually immoral past are in the genealogy. So what? Jesus was born of a sinful human race. He was without sin, but he sprang from a sinful race. Clark goes on, as to the objection that her husband is nowhere mentioned in the account here given, it appears to me to have little weight. In other words, the argument is Rahab's husband is not mentioned when she mentions her family members later on, so she doesn't have a husband, therefore she must be a prostitute. Well, that is a weak argument. Clark goes on to say she might have been either a single woman or a widow. And in either of these cases, there could have been no mention of a husband, or if she even had a husband, it is not likely he would have been mentioned on this occasion, as the secret seems to have been kept religiously between her and the spies. If she were a married woman, her husband might be included in the general terms and all that she had and all her kindred, which is mentioned in verse 23, Joshua 6. All right, so I think you see the debate right there from Adam Clark's statements. Jameson Fawcett Brown disagrees with Adam Clark. He says this, quote, many expositors desirous of removing the stigma of this name from an ancestress of the Savior have called her a hostess or a tavern keeper. But scriptural usage, and then Jameson Fawcett Brown quote 1, 2, 3, 4 passages, the authority of the Septuagint, followed by the apostles, Hebrews 11:31 and James 2:25, and the immemorial style of Eastern cons, which are never kept by women, established the propriety of the term employed in our version. So Jameson Fawston Brown says the custom in the ancient Near East in that area was for men to run taverns, inns, not women. Jameson Fawston Brown continue, her house was probably recommended to the spies by the convenience of its situation without any knowledge of the character of the inmates, but a divine influence directed them in the choice of that lodging place. So Jameson Fawston Brown says they didn't even know it was a whorehouse when they went there. I'm saying spies needing a place to stay, needing information, what's the best place in the world to go but a whorehouse? I don't think that messed up their morals because they went to a whorehouse carrying out their duties as spies. We go now to Joshua 2:2. It was told the king of Jericho, saying, "Behold, men from the sons of Israel have come here tonight to search out the land." So word got out somehow that the spies were spying out the land. John Gill says this, quote, "Who, being alarmed at the near approach of the Israelites," talking about people, whoever figured this out, "became alarmed at the near approach of the Israelites and knowing their claim to the land of Canaan and their design upon it," because that certainly had gotten out because of all the activities on the Transjordan area against Sihon and Og and Moab and all that. The word certainly had gotten over there into Canaan that the Israelites are coming. So these people of Jericho employed men to watch and observe what passed in the city and parts adjacent and inform the king of what was going on, of some persons of themselves and for their own safety and the good of their fellow citizens, gave notice to the king of it. So the people of Jericho were ready for the spies. They were looking for them, and they told the king. Now, how have these spies become known? Well, here's some options. Maybe it's because of their strange habits and language different from the people of Jericho. Maybe it's just because they were strangers. It's logical to deduce. You got strangers. You got a large body of Israelites massed on the border. Been there for a while. Several months at least. And then you see two strangers walking around. Well, sure. Those are spies. And so the spies were known. They were in a little bit of danger. Joshua 2:3-4. "And the king of Jericho sent word to Rahab, saying, 'Bring out the men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search out all the land.'" Well, not only did the king know that the two spies were in the land, he knew that the two spies had entered into Rahab's house. Somebody had snitched. Verse 4. "But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them, and she said, 'Yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from.'" Flat out lie. Now the fact that Rachel said in verse 3, excuse me, the fact that the messengers from the king of Jericho told Rahab to bring out the men is another argument that Rahab was not a prostitute. Clark brings this up, this argument. He says that the king's messengers, if the place had been a whorehouse, the king's messengers would have just gone in and taken prisoners. But here they seem to be respecting greatly the Eastern customs of hospitality. And so the argument is, this is not a whorehouse. Well, against that, I would say nobody is going to forcibly search a woman's apartment without permission, not even a prostitute's apartment. Jameson Fawston Brown says this, quote, "According to Eastern manners, which pay an almost superstitious respect to a woman's apartment, the royal messengers did not demand admittance to search, but asked her to bring the foreigners out." So, I still say it was a whorehouse. I don't care what Clark says. Now, Rahab had taken some precaution before the king's messengers got to her house. She had hidden the spies. She must have known the word had gotten out that the spies were there, and so she says, whoops, trouble's going to come. I got two spies here. So she was expecting to be searched, so she hid the spies. Now, some speculations as to where Rahab hid the spies. She could have hid them in different places temporarily before they were taken to the roof, so if one of the spies got caught, the other wouldn't. Or she could have just hid them directly on the roof before the messengers from the king of Jordan got there, and that's what I tend to think happened. She probably just lickety-split took them up on the roof. Now, what were her motives in hiding the two spies? Jameson Fawston Brown suggests that Eastern hospitality requires one to protect one's guest at all costs, and so she was going to protect her guest. I don't know if I'd go against the king just because of Eastern hospitality. Of course, I've never been experienced about Eastern hospitality, but I don't think that's a real reason why Rahab did this. I believe that she was afraid of Israel's might. She knew that Israel was getting ready to come into the Canaan land, and she wanted to be on Israel's good side. Now, let's look at Rachel's bald face lie that she told. She says, I did not know where they were from. Oh, yes, she did. She knew where they were from. And so we go to the eternal ethical debate. Was Rahab sinning when she lied like that? When I was at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School about 50 years ago, 1995 to be exact, well, that was about 35 years ago. I don't know. It's a long time ago. I had three professors who took three different positions on lying. And so I'm going to label these positions according to the professor. There was Walter Kaiser. I'm sure some of you might know him. He's a famous Old Testament scholar. He took the position that any lie in any circumstance is an absolute sin. End of story. And so he would have said that Rahab was sinning. She was sinning, and she should not have told the lie. And then there was the John Ward Montgomery position, which says that in a situation like that where you've got two competing ethical norms, one is to save this, save life, to save those lives, and the other, to save the lives of the two spies, and the other ethical obligation is to tell the truth. If you got two that conflict, you break the law, you break the ethical norm that causes the least damage, and then you ask forgiveness for it because you sinned, but you had no choice, so you ask forgiveness. So Montgomery's position was she sinned, but she should have told the lie. Kaiser's position was she sinned and she should not have told the lie. The third position was that of Norman Geisler, the famous apologist who recently passed on. His position was that in a situation like that, when you have an ethical conflict, you break the ethical norm which causes the least problem, and it is not a sin. So that's the Geisler position. So let's look and see if we might. Which position is correct concerning Ahab? First option is she was justified in lying. That's the Norman Geisler position. She was defending someone's life in a war situation. Now, no one, unless they're a pacifist, and that's wrong on other grounds, so let's just say no one in general would object to killing the enemy, so why should someone object to lying to the enemy? I mean, killing's not exactly the best thing in the world, but in warfare you have to do it, and in warfare you have to lie to the enemy. I mean, you got a general. What's the general going to do? Say, hey, guys, I'm going to send a message to the enemy here, and I'm going to tell the enemy where we're going to deploy tomorrow. Well, of course not. In fact, if you tell him anything, you tell him the opposite of the truth, and that would be considered part of generalship. And that's my solution. That was one thing I was impressed about Norman Geisler. He did advocate the banning of NASCAR during a gas crisis, which I thought was horrible and ironic since he ended up moving to the capital city of NASCAR, Charlotte, North Carolina, and he started a seminary down there. But at any rate, I believe that Geisler was right, and I can quote James 2:25 to back that up. In the same way, was not Rahab the harlot also justified? That means vindicated by works when she received the messengers and sent them out by another way. James doesn't say that Rahab was sinning in any way. And the Kaiser position that says that lies are wrong in any case, and the John Ward Montgomery position, which says that it's all right to lie, but you still got to ask God to forgive you for it after you do it. I don't think that fits this verse. Was not Rahab justified? Now, Montgomery could say, his position could say, well, she sinned and she was justified when she prayed for forgiveness for it. But that's not what James said. He says she was justified by works. She was vindicated by the thing she did, which was lying. So I think that answers it pretty good. Well, let's look at some other learned opinions. John Gill says, nah, she was unjustified. Now, this would cover either the Montgomery position or the Kaiser position. Both of them say that she is wrong, except that Kaiser's position is a little bit stronger, saying that she shouldn't have lied, period, where Montgomery says she should lie, but she has to ask forgiveness for it after she does. Well, this is what John Gill says. Evil is not to be done that good may come, nor are men to tell lies one to another upon any account, but these sins with others the Lord forgave her. That sounds like Kaiser's extreme position. She's wrong on all counts, in any account. Here's what Clark says, quote, no, there's no excuse for the woman's prevarication, for God could have saved his messengers independently of her falsity. God never says to any, do evil that good may come of it. Well, now I think that's a little bit hard upon our friend Rahab. No excuse for her prevarication. If she had told the truth, the spies would have been killed. Israel would not have been able to take Jericho, and if they did take Jericho, they couldn't take Canaan. Therefore, you would not have a promised land. Therefore, you would not have a Messiah. And therefore, we'd all be going to hell if Adam Clark was right, and he's not. Here's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say. As lying is a common vice among heathen people, Rahab was probably unconscious of its moral guilt, especially as she resorted to it as a means for screening her guest, and she might deem herself bound to do it by the laws of Eastern hospitality, which make it a point of honor to preserve the greatest enemy if he has once eaten one's salt. Judged by the divine law, her answer was a sinful expedient, but her infirmity being united with faith, she was graciously pardoned and her service accepted. That sounds close to the Montgomery position. She should have lied, but she sinned and had to get forgiveness for it. So now we turn to Joshua chapter 2, verses 5 through 7. At nightfall, when the gate was about to close, the men went out, and I don't know where they were going. Chased after them quickly, this is Rahab speaking to the two messengers from the king of Jericho. Chased after these spies quickly, says Rahab, and you can catch up with them. But she had taken them up to the roof and hidden them among the stalks of flax that she had arranged on the roof. The men pursued them along the road to the forks of the Jordan, to the fords of the Jordan. And as soon as they left to pursue them, the gate was shut. Now, what gate is being talked about here? That's the gate to the city of Jericho. Rahab lived in the city wall of Jericho, facing east. And somewhere in that city wall was the gate. And so before the gate closed, when it was about to close, Rachel told the spies, you better get out. You better run out and chase them. Maybe you can catch up with them. But actually, they were up on the roof, on the top of her inn. Then she says, chase after them quickly, because Rahab wanted the king's messengers out of her house ASAP. Now, talking that way, of course, made it look like Rahab had no part in the spies' fortunes, that she wanted the messengers of Jericho to catch the spies, and so she was playing the part quite well. Now, verse 6 says, but she had taken them up on the roof, and the timing is a little bit ambiguous. She could have taken them up before the messengers came, or she could have taken them up after the messengers from Jericho came. Messengers from the king of Jericho came. If you translate it, but she took them up to the roof, that sounds like she did it afterwards. And but she had taken them up on the roof, sounds like she had done it before the messengers came. But it doesn't make any difference. The point is they were up there. And remember, it was on the roof. All roofs in the east were flat at that time. Now, the fact that she hid the spies in flax is used by John Gill as an argument in favor of Rahab being a virtuous and industrious woman, not a prostitute, because flax was used for making linen, and that showed that Rahab was being industrious in making clothes. Well, this is what I would say to Mr. Gill. Prostitutes can be industrious, too. They can make a living in more ways than one. I don't think that's a good argument. I think she was a prostitute. Now, she might have later stopped being a prostitute, and I hope she did. But no, she was a prostitute. It's these people just can't stand the thought of having a prostitute in Jesus' genealogy. It drives them crazy, people like Adam Clark and John Gill. Now, the two messengers from the king of Jericho, they left Rahab's establishment, went outside the gates of Jericho, and pursued the spies, or what they thought were the spies. They followed the tracks of what they thought were the spies along the road to the fords of the Jordan. But the spies were up on the roof, and the gate was shut, and the spies are inside now. Now, the fords were a logical place for the king's messengers to look for the spies, because naturally the spies would head there trying to get back east over the Jordan River back home. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says that there were basically five fords across the Galilee River, the Jordan River. The first and second fords were immediately below the Sea of Galilee. The third and fourth fords were immediately above and below the pilgrim's bathing place outside Jericho. I said five, actually four here, all the way down to Jericho. So there were lots of places to cross the Galilee, the Sea of, lots of places to cross the Jordan River. And so there were logical places for these king's messengers to go look for the spies, but they didn't find them. Why? Because the spies were up on the roof. Now, the gate was shut to the city right after the spies left. Why? Well, it could be that the city of Jericho wanted to be sure the spies would not come back into the city and spy them out. Or it could be the city authorities who shut the gates thought that maybe the spies were still in the city and they wanted to keep them in, or maybe it was both one and two. Both options one and number two, if the spies were outside, they didn't want them back in, and if they were inside, they would be caught. So we go now to Joshua 2, verses 8 through 13. Now, before they lay down, the two Israeli spies, she, that's Rahab, came up to them on the roof and said to the men, I know that the Lord has given you the land and that the terror of you has fallen on us and that all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. When we heard it, our hearts melted, and no courage remained in any man any longer because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God, in heaven above and on earth beneath. Now therefore, please swear to me by the Lord, since I have dealt kindly with you, that you also will deal kindly with my father's household, and give me a pledge of truth, and spare my father and my mother and my brother and my sisters with all who belong to them, and deliver our lives from death. Now here you can see that Rahab was convinced that God was powerful, that the Israelites were powerful, and that's why she hid those spies. She risked her life with the king of Jordan because she figured Israel was stronger than Jordan, and she was right. Now this might have been a pure pragmatic thing. I don't see why we would say Rahab was particularly spiritual because she gave aid and comfort to the forces of Yahweh. But back then, if you just did something, that was considered a good thing, a pious thing. So Rahab did a good thing. She protected the spies. Now, why did Rahab go to the spies on the roof in verse 8? Well, she wanted to tell them what happened. The two envoys from the king of Jericho had come looking for them, and they were now outside the city, running down to the forts looking for them. She then professes her loyalty to Israel to the spies by saying that she knows that the Lord has given you the land. She knows the Israelites are going to win. Now, how does she know? Adam Clark says this, possibly the knowledge of the true God was general in the earth at this time, though connected with much superstition and idolatry, the people believing that there was a God for every district and for every people, for the mountains and for the valleys. So in other words, when she says, I know that the Lord, that's Yahweh, has given you the land, she might have conceived of Yahweh as a local territorial deity. Well, there's the practical way she knew, of course, that the Lord had given them the land was because she had heard of all the incidents of the Egypt. She had heard how Sihon and Og, the powers in the region there right across the Jordan River, had been utterly destroyed. That could not have been secret. There's a whole army of Israelites over there wiping people out. Well, that's how she knew. I mean, you can say it was divine revelation. Adam Clark suggests she received instruction from the spies telling her what Israel had done, but I don't think that's necessary. I think it was just reputation. The word had gotten out that the Israelites were coming, and Rahab made her choice. The two kings, Sihon and Og, who had just been beaten, that had just happened just a few months before, right before Moses gave his final discourses on the plains of Moab, right before Moses died, and then there was a 30-day mourning period for Moses. Then the Israelites they were getting ready to prepare to come over. That hadn't happened yet, most probably, but the spies had been sent out. So we're just talking about a couple of months. So Rahab's got plenty of reason to know the Yahweh that she was dealing with. Now, in verse 11, she said, For the Lord your God, Yahweh Elohim, I think that's what the Hebrew says there, for the Lord your God, he is God. Now, Rahab's confession of faith here is why she is so kindly mentioned in the New Testament, Hebrews 11:31. By faith, Rahab the harlot did not perish along with those who were disobedient after she had welcomed the spies in peace. James 2:25. In the same way, was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works? That means vindicated by works when she received the messengers and sent them out by another way. That justified does not mean legally, forensically justified, made just and righteous and holy in the sight of God. No, that's not what it means. It just means she was vindicated. Her actions were vindicated by the fact that she survived the Hebrew invasion. That's why she was justified. And notice that James calls her a harlot. That's the way the Greek is translated. I believe she was a prostitute. Now, in verse 12, she asks for safety. This is basically a tit for tat. She says, Look, Hebrew spies, I treated you kindly. I saved your neck. Now, how about save my family's neck when the Hebrews come invading this land? It's fair enough. Now, she says, spare my father's household in verse 12. She does not mention a husband and children, and so we assume she does not have a husband and children because harlots seldom have these. I know I talked to a professor in China who was talking about sex workers' lives in China, and she said that one of the greatest dreams that these girls have as they flee from the poor countryside into the big city of Beijing or other big cities, they want a husband and a family, and they're making money to get it, and they don't want to be a whore. They want to be a wife, which is amazing to me. You usually don't think that way. Maybe that's just in China. I don't know. But typically, they typically had no husband and wife. That's what they were wanting. And right here, Rahab didn't have a husband and children. And so that's one more argument that she actually was a whore and not an innkeeper. Now, in verse 12, she asked the two Hebrew spies to swear to me by the Lord, swear by Yahweh. Now, there's nothing stronger than that, boy. You swear by Yahweh. I mean, even today, I'm scared to swear by God the Father or Jesus. I don't do that. But she said, do that. Swear by Yahweh. Now, Adam Clark says, by this request, we see that, quote, this is a further proof that this woman had received considerable instruction in the Jewish faith. She acknowledged the true God by his essential character, Jehovah, Yahweh, and knew that an oath in his name was the deepest and most solemn obligation under which a Jew could possibly come. So what Clark is saying by the very fact that Rahab asked for an oath in Yahweh's name shows that she knew something about Yahweh. She was learning. The pagans were learning about the true God. Oh, would that the American pagans show such facility in learning. Joshua 2:14, we continue. The men answered her, the two spies, we will give our lives for yours. If you don't report our mission, we will show kindness and faithfulness to you when the Lord gives us the land. Now, when the spies say, we will give our lives for yours, he's referring to the lives of Rahab's relatives, the lives that she just asked for. And basically what they're saying is, look, we will die if our army does anything to your relatives. May God strike us dead. In other words, we're going to look after your relatives. If you don't report our mission, well, their mission searching the land was already known. That's why the two messengers from the king of Jericho were looking for him. So there's no point in swearing Rahab to secrecy about that. But where the spies were located in carrying out their mission, where the spies were located in the mission of spying out the land, that was not long known, and that's what they meant. In other words, Rahab, don't tell anybody where we are. If you'll do that, we will show kindness and faithfulness to you when the Lord gives us the land. And that's probably the land around Jericho, not the whole land of Canaan. Land around Jericho was soon, and that's what Rahab was concerned with at the moment, not the whole land of Canaan. We go down to Joshua 2, verses 15 and 16. Then she, Rahab, let them down by a rope through the window, for her house was on the city wall, so that she was living on the wall. She said to them, go to the hill country, so that the pursuers will not happen upon you, and hide yourself there for 3 days until the pursuers return. Then afterward you may go on your way. In other words, she's saying, look, I've just sent the two messengers from the king of Jericho down to the fords. You go the other way up into the hills as the valley of the Jordan River starts climbing up into the hill country. You go there and hang out for 3 days, and then the pursuers will return back to the king. The two messengers of the king of Jericho will go back to the king, and then the fords will be open. The roads to the fords will be open, and you can get out of here. Now, verse 15 says she let them down by a rope through the window. There's a question about whether she told them this strategy of staying for 3 days in the hills until the pursuers went away. Did she tell them that before she let them down or after she let them down and they were on the ground? Jameson Fawcett Brown says that it was probably after she let them down by a rope, after she had already given them instructions, which makes sense to me. John Gill says, however, it is possible that she talked to the spies outside the city wall after letting them down, because there outside the wall, it would be safe to talk there unobserved and unheard. Well, it's a minor detail in the story. Now, she says to the spies, go to the hill country so that the pursuers, that's the two messengers from the king of Jericho, so that the pursuers will not happen upon you. Now, what she means here is that if the spies go straight down to the fords, the messengers might accidentally run upon them as they return back to Jericho, which would be quite unfortunate. So she says, don't go there. Don't go the roads down to the fords. And she gives them 3 days to hide in the hill country because she figures that's about how long before the messengers will give up looking for the spies, which is reasonable. We go now to Joshua 2, verses 17 through 20. The men said to her, that's the two Hebrew spies, We shall be free from this oath to you which you have made us swear, and that oath, of course, was to not hurt Rahab's family, unless when we come into the land you tie this cord of scarlet thread in the window through which you let us down, and gather to yourself and to the house your father and your mother and your brothers and all your father's household. It shall come about that anyone who goes out of the doors of your house into the street, his blood shall be on his own head, and we shall be free, i.e. free from their oath, to not kill. But anyone who is with you in the house, his blood shall be on our head if a hand is laid on him. But if you tell this business of ours, then we shall be free from the oath which you have made us swear. So the Hebrew spies agree to swear, but conditions. The family's got to stay in the house. There's got to be a red cord so that the invading Israeli army, the invading Hebrew armies, will know which house they're supposed to not harm. If there was no way to tell that, they would have to harm none of the houses, which means they couldn't conquer Jericho. So she had to put that red cord out of the window. Now, there's a disagreement in the commentators concerning this major issue. Was the rope that let the spies down out of the window, was that the same scarlet cord that is to be hung in the window? Or were there two different items, a rope and a scarlet cord? Martin Luther says the scarlet cord and the rope were the same things. That commentator Ellicott says that the scarlet cord and the rope are two different things. And his reasons for that is, first of all, the Hebrew words for the rope and the cord are different Hebrew words. And also, if she hung the cord out of the window in letting the spies down, that scarlet cord would be there, and everyone would say, well, hey, Rahab, what's that scarlet cord for? Perhaps it's because you let spies escape from your place? You know, already she was under suspicion. Ellicott says this, quote, it would have been preposterous to require Rahab to display in her window the means by which the spies had escaped. It would at once have declared the tale to all beholders, the very thing Rahab was pledged not to do. So I think Martin, with all due respect, as one of the founders of the Reformation, I think you're wrong on that point. Now, this scarlet thread that will later be let out of the window by Rahab is often said by preachers today to be a type of the blood of Christ because it saved the life of the whore and her family. Well, again, I'm conservative on types. I'm not sure that's a type, but if you want to use that for an application, that's fine. Now, one little problem here is that we try to picture this scene here. The window that is the spies were let down from is in the east wall of the city. That window is facing outside the city. If the invading Israelites come from the west, they're not going to be able to see the cord. Well, the answer to that, a possible answer to that, is the gate to the city was actually on the east, not on the west, and so the soldiers might have entered on the east and seen the scarlet thread. And then once they got inside the gate, they could remember which house they saw the thread hanging from as they went to the inside and approached the house from the west. Or it could be that Israel's soldiers could have approached the house from the east, seen the cord, then gone around and found the gate, which might have been on the west, and gone in through that way and remembered where the house was. It's a minor detail, but we see how the whole business was meant to work. We now go to Joshua 2, verses 21 through 24. She, that's Rahab, said, according to your words, so be it. According to the words of the two Hebrew spies, so be it. So she sent them away, and they departed, and she tied the scarlet cord in the window. They departed and came to the hill country and remained there for 3 days until the pursuers returned. Now the pursuers had sought them all along the road, but had not found them. Then the two men returned and came down from the hill country and crossed over and came to Joshua the son of Nun, and they related to him all that had happened to them. They said to Joshua, Surely the Lord has given all the land into our hands. Moreover, all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before us. Now remember, the gate had already been shut, but they had been let down out a window out through the east wall, so they were outside the city of Jericho. They didn't need to worry about the gate being shut. She ties the scarlet cord in the window. If she did it immediately, that would just violate Ellicott's logic here that she would not do that so soon anyway, because that would then tell everybody, hey, what's that scarlet cord doing at the window? Maybe it's because the spies were let down through your window as you were being accused of. So it could be she tied the scarlet cord in the window later than at the exact time that she let the spies out. If she did it quickly, it was to confirm to the spies that she meant what she had said, so that as soon as she was let down, as the spies were let down through the window, they could look up and see the cord. They say, ah, she means business. or it would be to encourage her own faith that she would be safe. She was more worried about the invading Hebrew army than she was about people finding out that there was a red cord in her window that might be a telltale giveaway. So we can speculate about all that when she put the cord in the window. So the two Hebrew spies stayed in the hill country until the pursuers returned. In verse 22, they returned. That means they returned to Jericho and went to see the king of Jericho. Now the pursuers had sought them all along the road. That would be the roads down to the fords, the logical place for the spies to be. And of course, the spies weren't there. They were in the hills, so they didn't find them. The spies come safely to Joshua. He's still at Shittim, the acacia grove there, somewhere near Mount Pisgah, Mount Moab. And the spies say to Joshua, "Surely the Lord has given all the land into our hands." Now, why were the spies so positive, so excited by their prospects? Well, they saw how fearful the inhabitants were. They saw how they were being chased by the spies. Oh my gosh, the Israelites, the Hebrews are coming, the Hebrews are coming. They listened to Rachel talk about all of her fear about the Hebrews coming. And so this piece of information was probably the thing Joshua wanted most to know. Nothing else is told to Joshua by the spies, nothing of strategic interest, like which ford to take, like which valley to go. It's just the attitude, the psychological condition of the inhabitants of Jericho, Joshua now knows. And so now Joshua is prepared to take the people of Israel across the Jordan River, which we will see in the next chapter, chapter 3. But before I go there, I need to take care of two minor details. In this audio, I presumed that Rachel's house was on the east side of the city. I don't know why I presumed that. I must have had the idea in my head from some reading in the past. I just read an archaeological website that said that they found a pile of bricks that must have been Rahab's house on the north. Actually, the scripture doesn't say where her house was. It's a minor detail, but I do need to mention it in the interest of accuracy. Also, I said that the messengers from Jericho were two. The passage does not say how many messengers from the king of Jericho came looking for the spies at Rahab's house. I think I conflated the two spies with the two messengers of Jericho, so I apologize for those minor errors deeply and sincerely. All right, now we're ready to proceed to chapter 3, our next audio. Israel will finally cross the Jordan River and go into the promised land. I hope to see you in that next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.